We met each other through a series of really extraordinary circumstances. And it was one of those things that you never are going to believe where you're going to go. And what happens with Alcoholics Anonymous and me is I just say yes, and things happen. And we had been given an opportunity to go to this retreat in Georgia. And I'm like, what do I want to go in Georgia for? And put it off. And I'm like, you know how we are. We're much more comfortable in our county, in our town. We don't even want to go to a meeting that's 20 minutes away, let alone one that requires plane, train, automobiles, and all that stuff. But I was at a point in my sobriety that I needed more. My sponsor at the time had moved to Sponsorland. You guys know that means Florida. And I was seeking teachers. I was at a place in my life where I needed more teachers. And so I grabbed my traveling partner of the moment, which was Julie, and we wandered down there. And there, a couple things happened. We got waylaid in D.C., and it TSA is brutal. And, you know, I got body searched, you know, where they touched me. And I can't. And, I mean, it really threw me off, this invasion. And I get down there, and we're late, and we're driving, and we can't find the place. We have no idea where we're going. We're just following directions, and we get to this big old camp on St. Simon's Island in Georgia, and it was dark, and, you know, I don't know if you know, they have, like, the trees with the moss hanging down, so it's kind of spooky, you know, and it wasn't a welcoming committee for me. It wasn't a welcoming place that we went to at all. And we're driving down there, and we're late, so we haven't met anybody. And we get in, and we check in, and they send us. And we're not even, like in a retreat house. We're in different cabins. So Julie and I still look at each other like, what did we do? Like, where are we? And no one's saying hello to us. And I don't know what we were expecting. But then, so we go to breakfast, and we sit down in this big old meeting hall. And there had to be like 200 people there, more people than were just in our group. And so we don't know what we're doing. We go sit off to the side. And Polly wanders over. She doesn't have a name tag on because she's a very wise sponsor. You know, cunning, baffling. No name tag. She comes and she must have spotted that we were new, or someone told her that, you know, I don't know. So she sits down, and I said, are you from the retreat? And she said, I sure am. And I said, well, what happened last night? We missed it, because I wanted to hear the ladybug story. And she just started to talk to us, and then I was like, no, then we figured out that it was Polly. And I was like, oh, my God. She said, well, what happened? I'm telling her about this outrageous experience that I felt so violated on the plane. And I said, well, what's the topic? And she goes, intimacy. And I just went, oh, my God. So God put me in a place I needed to go to meet an unbelievable teacher who has entered our lives. And that's only because I said yes to a form and bothered to try something different. Even though it was scary, I was okay because I was safe and protected in my program of Alcoholics Anonymous and with the people around me. I always get that sense when I need to be shifted, you know, and seeking new teachers has been part of that process. So with that, I had heard Polly, and then when I found out what was her, I couldn't believe it because I had heard this workshop on tape before it was a CD. I heard it on tape, and it helped me in my personal relationships. It helped me in my wackadoo marriage to recognize that I was in an unhealthy relationship, and I really had to face that. It helped me to deal with some of the unhealthy relationships I had in recovery. So it's been of great help to me, and it's also using the steps and traditions we find in our work. So I want to read the old preamble, and I'll turn it over to Polly and Dave, who I never met before now. I only hear everything about him. Okay. We're gathered here because we are faced with the fact that we are powerless over alcohol and unable to do anything about it without the help of a power greater than ourselves. We feel that each person's religious views, if any, are his own affair. The simple purpose of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is to show that what may be done to enlist the aid of a power greater than ourselves, regardless of what our individual conception of that power may be. In order to form a habit of depending upon and referring all we do to that power, we must first apply ourselves with some diligence. By often repeating these acts, they become habitual, and the help rendering becomes natural to us. We have all come to know that as alcoholics, we are suffering from a serious illness for which medicine has no cure. Our condition may be the result of an allergy, which makes us different from other people. It has never been any treatment with which we are familiar permanently cured. The only relief we have to offer is the absolute abstinence, the second meaning of AA. There are no dues or fees. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. Each member squares his debt by helping others to recover. An Alcoholics Anonymous is an alcoholic who, through the application adherence to the AA program, has forsworn the use of any and all alcoholic beverage in any form. The moment he takes so much as one drop of beer, wine, spirits, or any other alcoholic beverage, he automatically loses all status as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. AA is not interested in sobering our drunks who are not sincere in their desire to remain sober for all time. Not being reformers, we offer our experience only to those who want it. We have a way out on one we can absolutely agree on, one which we can join in harmonious action. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our program. Those who do not recover are people who will not or simply cannot give themselves to this simple program. Now, you may like this program or you may not, but the fact remains it works. It's our only chance to recover. There's a vast amount of fun in AA fellowship. Some people might be shocked at our seeming worldliness and levity, but just underneath there lies a deadly earnestness and full realization that we must put first things first. And with each of us, the first thing is our alcoholic problem. To drink is to die. Faith must work 24 hours a day in and through us, or we perish. In order to set our tone for this meeting, I ask us to bow our heads in a few moments of silent prayer and meditation. I want you to ask the God of your understanding to give you open-mindedness for a new experience this morning, so that you might hear what Polly and Dave have to give offer you in a different way that you might not have before. Okay, breathe nice and deep. I'm introducing Polly and Dave from Jacksonville, Florida.
I don't think that, is it on? It's on.
Oh, it's on, yeah.
Doesn't make noise if you tap on it. It's because it's got a windsock on it, or a sock. Okay, my name's Dave. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Dave.
I know I don't look like one, but alas, it is true. Part of what we're going to do is, part of what I'm going to do, I don't know, Polly, if you want to know what she's going to do, you have to ask her, but part of what I'm going to do is try to broaden the scope of understanding. In addition to this workshop, I'm going to flavor it with an attempt to broaden the scope of understanding that some of you who are new or nearly new may have of Alcoholics Anonymous, because often we have no idea what AA, the scope and breadth of Alcoholics Anonymous in the world. And so that's not going to be a big deal, but that's what I'm going to flavor some of my stuff with. And I want to start off by reading something. It just really touches me. In my judgment, such of us who have never fallen victims to alcohol have been spared more by the absence of appetite than from any mental or moral superiority over those who have. Indeed, I believe if we take habitual drunkards as a class, their heads and their hearts will bear an advantageous comparison with those of any other class. There seems ever to have been a proneness in the brilliant and warm-blooded to fall into the vice. The demon of intemperance ever seems to have delighted in sucking the blood of genius and generosity. The victim should be pitied and compassionated, just as are the heirs of consumption and other hereditary diseases. Their failings should be treated as misfortune and not as a crime or even a disgrace. And that was said by Mr. Abraham Lincoln, President Abraham Lincoln. So, we travel in good company. In the early 1940s, at the Mayflower Hotel in Akron, Ohio, there was a Friday Forum Luncheon Club of Alcoholics Anonymous who said this: your talk deserves the very best effort you can put into it. This is part of their instructions to new people. Anything having to do with sobriety deserves nothing but the best. You can avoid the embarrassment of stumbling around groping for words and ideas if you will use the forethought of preparation. This does not mean sit down and write out a speech, but organize your subject matter beforehand. If you have any doubts as to your memory, and remember you may experience stage fright, prepare written notes. After preparing them, follow them closely, or you may get off on a tangent, find yourself in a thicket of verbiage, and have difficulty in finding your way back into your notes. Remember, you owe your audience some consideration. To speak before a group with no preparation is an insult to their intelligence. So rather than insult your intelligence, we have notes. Man, do we have notes. And if you should happen to want the notes, there is a little tablet lying up here in the right-hand corner of this table that has a web address, a user ID, and a password on it. And if you want the notes we're going to use this morning, this is where they are, along with other stuff. And they are, you can do anything you want to with them. You can print them and get a rag puller to drop them all over Manhattan. You can, whatever you want. They are created and provided in the spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous for fun and for free. And we did it this way because we got tired of lugging all those paper copies of them around. So they're yours. If you want them, go get them. And please, I've only written this down one time, so please just make a copy. There's a tablet here, so there's plenty of paper up here, but please just make a copy of what's up here. There's a user ID and a password on them because in the spirit of anonymity, we don't want web crawlers like Yahoo and Bing and Google and all those web crawlers to find them. There are some people who have made copies, paper copies of these, and they're tapers, and they sell them for $2 a copy. That is without our prior consent or even knowledge in many cases. The latest copy, because they've been revised at least annually ever since the early 90s, the latest copy will be on that website.
Dave, and do you want to read that onto the CD?
I can read it onto the CD, absolutely.
Thank you.
Okie dokie, what a great idea. Okay, http://www.jamesl.org/billw. And the user ID is Dave, D-A-V-E, and the password is Polly, P-O-L-L-Y.
Wait, what is that? Sorry,
what is what?
Dave and Polly.
User ID is Dave, password's Polly. And I'll leave them up here anyway. So, now, to start off with, I can't do anything if it's not fun, and that includes AA. So, among other things, we're going to have fun. Okay, I have a book here. I have a volume before me that is so rare as to be almost non-existent, and it says, "Men are like waffles, women are like spaghetti." And I'm going to read a short excerpt from the first two or three pages of this book. Okay, what we mean is that men process life in boxes. If you look down at a waffle, you see a collection of boxes separated by walls. The boxes are all separate from each other and make convenient holding places. That is typically how a man processes life. Our thinking is divided up into boxes that have room for one issue and one issue only. The first issue of life goes in the first box, the second goes in the second box, and so on. The typical man lives in one box at a time. When a man is at work, he is at work. When he is in the garage tinkering around, he is in the garage tinkering. When he is watching TV, he is simply watching TV. That is why he looks as though he is in a trance and can ignore everything else going on around him. Social scientists call this compartmentalizing, and that is putting life and responsibilities into different compartments. As a result, men are problem solvers by nature. They enter a box, size up the problem, formulate a solution. In their careers, they consider what it will take to be successful and focus on it. In communication, they look for the bottom line and get there as quickly as possible. In decision-making, they look for an approach they can buy into and apply as often as possible. A man will strategically organize his life in boxes and then spend most of his time in boxes he can succeed in. This is such a strong motivation for him that he will seek out the boxes that work and will ignore the boxes that confuse him or make him feel like a failure. For instance, a man whose career holds the possibility of success will spend more and more time at work at the expense of other priorities. On the other hand, a man who always falls short at work or feels he never meets the expectations around him may find out that he is pretty good at being lazy. He will then develop a commitment to being lazy because he knows he can do that today with the same proficiency as yesterday. Men also take a success approach to communication. If they believe they can successfully talk with their wives and reach a desirable outcome, they will be highly motivated to converse. If, on the other hand, the conversation seems pointless to him or he finds understanding his wife impossible, he loses his motivation to talk and clams up. That is why men come up with profound things to say, such as, "Is there any point to this conversation? Is this conversation leading anywhere? Can you just get to the point?" These are statements a man makes out of frustration because he doesn't know how to make conversation with his wife work. In contrast to men's waffle-like approach, women process life more like a plate of pasta. If you look at a plate of spaghetti, you notice there are lots of individual noodles that all touch one another. If you attempted to follow one noodle around the plate, you would intersect a lot of other noodles, and you might even switch to another noodle seamlessly. This is how women face life. Every thought and issue is connected to every other thought and issue in some way. Life is much more of a process for women than it is for men. That is why women are typically better at multitasking than men. She can talk on the phone, prepare a meal, make a shopping list, work on the agenda for tomorrow's business meeting, give instructions to her children as they are going out to play, and close the door with her foot without skipping a beat. Because all her thoughts, emotions, and convictions are connected, she is able to process more information and keep track of more activities. As a result, women are in pursuit of connecting life together. They solve problems, but from a much different perspective than men. For women to quickly solve a problem when the issues involved in the discussion are disconnected from each other is an act of denial. And so women consistently sense the need to talk things through. In conversation, she can link together the logical, emotional, relational, and spiritual aspects of the issues. The links come to her naturally, so the conversation is effortless for her. She is able to connect all the issues together. The answer to the question at hand bubbles to the surface and is readily accepted. This often creates significant stress for couples because while she is making all the connections, he is frantically jumping from box to box trying to keep up with the conversation. The man's eyes are rolling back in his head while a tidal wave of information is swallowing him up. When she is done, she feels better and he is overwhelmed. The conversation might look something like this. Joan gets home and says, "Honey, how was your day?" "I had a good day. We have just committed to a new educational wing at the university, and I've been asked to oversee the budget. I am so excited that they didn't rule me out because I am a woman. You know, women have been fighting for a place in society for decades, and it is good to see so much progress being made. I think it is neat that you treat women who work for you with so much respect. Our daughter is so lucky to have you for a dad. Do you remember that Susie has a soccer game tonight? I think it is important we are there because the Johnsons are going to be there, and I really want you to meet them. Susie and Bethany are getting to be good friends, and I think we should get to know her parents as well." As John is exploring this conversation, Dan is getting lost. He has no idea what the budget at the university has to do with their daughter's soccer game and their need to have a friendship with the Johnsons. He admires her ability to connect seemingly unrelated thoughts that he just can't seem to understand how she does it. One of the characteristics that creates havoc in male-female interaction is the fact that most men have boxes in their waffle that have no words. There are thoughts in these boxes about the past, their work, and pleasant experiences, but these thoughts do not turn into words. A man is able to be quite happy in these wordless boxes because the memories he carries in them have significant meaning to him. The problem is that he cannot communicate these experiences to others, and so his wife may feel left out. Not all the wordless boxes have thoughts, however. There are actually boxes in the average man's waffle that contain no words and no thoughts. These boxes are just as blank as a white sheet of paper. They are empty. To help relieve stress in his life, he will park in these boxes to relax. Amazingly, his wife always seems to notice when he is in park. She observes his blank look and the relaxed posture he has taken on the couch. She assumes this is a good time to talk, as he is so relaxed. And so she invariably asks, "What are you thinking, sweetheart?" He immediately panics because he knows if he tells the truth, she'll think he's lying. She cannot imagine a moment without words in her mind. If he says nothing, she thinks he is hiding something and is afraid to talk about it. She becomes instantly curious and mildly suspicious. Not wanting to disappoint his wife, his eyes start darting back and forth, hoping to find some box in close proximity that has words in it. If he finds a box of words quickly, he will engage his wife in conversation, and both will feel good about the relationship. If he is slow in finding words, her suspicion fails to be extinguished, and he feels a sense of failure. He desperately wants to explain to his wife that he sometimes just goes blank. Nothing is wrong. Nothing is in denial. Nothing is being hidden. This is the way he has been his whole life, and she cannot imagine that. So, you know, while this is obviously meant to be funny, it is nevertheless very true. Polly often asks me, "What are you thinking?" And the correct, honest answer is, "Nothing as far as I know." I'm really not thinking anything. It's like you just sort of like disappear for a while. And so... This is a book called Men Are Like Waffles, Women Are Like Spaghetti, Understanding and Delighting in Your Differences. So we are going to plow ahead. The idea is, Polly and I have been doing this workshop for almost 20 years. It has changed dramatically over the years. The original notes for this workshop and the way they are today are, with the exception of some core things, have changed quite a bit. Why? Because the world changes. We change. And so in order to keep fresh and current, Joseph Campbell said that we have to keep our myths and our ideas alive. You know, if we freeze them in time, they will gradually decay and become irrelevant and therefore useless. And we have in Alcoholics Anonymous, we have ideas for changing things. You know, if you're new or nearly new and you come in here thinking that our big book needs some work, many of us will agree with you, you know. Many of us, if you think it is funny that a man wrote the chapter to the wives, so do many of us. Some of us think that maybe the chapter on working with others could use a little rewrite. I mean, when that was written, there were only two meetings in the world. And now there's one on every corner. And now the way newcomers get into Alcoholics Anonymous and the way we deal with them is vastly different from the way it was in the late 1930s and early 1940s. The problem is, when ideas come along like gender-neutral big books and all that sort of thing, those usually come from some poor GSR who got railroaded. Who knows? He's been sober about 15 or 20 minutes. He just joined the group, and nobody wants to do it, so they railroad some poor little schmuck into doing that. And to him or her, a gender-neutral big book may sound like a good idea. So the problem is we don't want anybody touching that book. We don't care how out of date it gets. We don't want anybody touching it. We don't care if you change the words and all that, but we are afraid that we will lose the spirit of the book, the essence of our program. And that's the essence of our lives. That's our lifeblood, what's in that book. There are about 2 million people walking around on this planet who are sober because of that book. Now, we don't know if there's 2 million or 10 million or 122,000. It's just 2 million is a number we don't argue over, so we use it. But the way we keep our program alive is that we have people that go around and share their experience, strength, and hope. And their experience is current. Their hope is current. Their strength is current. And so these people who speak at AA meetings, and that includes all of you, keep our program current and alive and fresh. And we don't have to change the foundation of our program, and it is not allowed to decay and become irrelevant because of that. So these notes have changed quite a bit, and we'll continue to do so. And we got it from a lot of different places. The unity of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon is just about the most cherished and valuable quality that we have. And our lives and all who are yet to find us depend on our being unified. Somebody has to be sitting here with a smile on their face when the next copy of you walks in. They just do. Somebody was sitting here when you walked in, and they welcomed you. And if you had it within you, if it was possible with you to open up enough to let something sneak in, you would have felt the love and the care that they had for you. We have 12 steps in this program, as you all know, and those are what put our lives in order. The 12 steps will allow me to become a brand new human being, and I have been. They absolutely work. My experience is they work unbelievably well. They so richly deserved my ridicule and my disbelief when I got here, because that's all I was capable of. But I had no idea they were going to do this to me. And fortunately, because it probably would have just scared the hell out of me if I'd have had any idea what was about to happen to me. But they don't necessarily put our relationships in order. How to live successfully with other people, with those around us, are what our traditions are all about. And so that is why we use the ideas that underlie the 12 traditions for this workshop that we're doing. So most of what we'll be sharing with you is going to be based on our personal adventures, both before and since our marriage. And it's our desire to share with you what has actually happened to us and what we really did, rather than what we think. So the emphasis is on experience of what we did rather than our opinion of what you should do. Because what you should do, if we comment on that, all you're getting is our opinion. And all too often, somebody's opinion may be worth exactly what it costs you, which is nothing. So Polly and I were married on October the 27th of 1980. So on October the 27th, we will celebrate 31 years of marriage. We each believe we have the most wonderful mate in the world, and we hope you feel that way about yours if you have one, or if you want one. We are, however, not each other's first spouse. Polly was married once before me, lasted for a long, long time. Polly is my fourth wife. That's right, four. And as a dear Al-Anon friend named Carol likes to point out, Dave, you were the only common denominator in all three of those miserable failures. Bitch. And tell you, I was going to have fun. So the problem was nobody knew how to conduct a relationship. I didn't. Polly didn't. And the problem was we're alcoholics. You know, we're ignorant. We're selfish. We're self-centered. We didn't know how to do anything really when it came to interpersonal relationships. We just didn't. You know, I mean, it wasn't that we thought well of ourselves. It was that we thought only of ourselves. A symptom of alcoholism, or maybe better stated, our humanness, is that from time to time we just become restless and irritable and discontent. That is a statement that was made by the good Dr. Silkworth. His exact quote was, "They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort, which comes at once by taking a few drinks." That is absolutely true. Comes at once by taking a few drinks. Or eating a half gallon of ice cream at midnight, or being sexually frantic, or gambling away the grocery money, or any number of other ways that we can try to use, that we use to try to get in control of our emotions and our feelings. You know, don't worry about getting in touch with your feelings. Your feelings are going to get in touch with you. So, you know, we don't ever seem to understand why these things happen. You know, those around us, when we get into one of those states, they usually want to know, why are you in that state? What did I do to cause this? Because we're selfish and self-centered. What do I have to do to end it? And is it ever going to happen again? And nobody, I mean, yeah, it's going to happen again. Of course it is. That is just an aspect of alcoholism. And so, frequently Polly insists on assuming part of the responsibility for my, sometimes all of it, for my being in that state. You know, and sometimes I don't anymore, but she doesn't anymore either. I mean, we've changed dramatically. But it used to be that, you know, I would encourage her to take responsibility. You know, I mean, I didn't discourage that at all. If I had the response that I had, you know, my main aim was to make sure that you were not able to copy and paste any of this problem on me. Okay. I wanted to appear as, I mean. You just misunderstood, dear. We were persistently frustrated in not knowing what our role in relationship was or any of that thing. You know, and there are some things that, you know, that if you like chronic frustration, I have some, you know, and anxiety. I can recommend some things to you. First of all, make sure that you are easily offended. At the drop of a hat, you know. I mean, and if you're not offended, pretend that you are. Insist on being right. Never give up, okay? Never surrender. Insist on being right. Make sure that you win or appear to win at everything. For alcoholics, we don't care if we win. We just want to appear to win. Appearing to win is good. Pay close attention to how much stuff you have, okay? In the game of life, you know, how does your stuff compared to everybody else's stuff? Do you have more or less? And if you have less, go get some more. Rely on your achievement, real or imagined. You know, get degrees, get whatever you have to do to be to have a high level of achievement, and you expect that to give you self-esteem. It won't, but it's a dream worth chasing, and it will keep you anxious and frustrated. Do what you can to make your reputation and character appear immaculate at all times. Don't admit anything. Lying is entirely appropriate here. Just never open the kimono and give them a peek at the real you. So, you know, and these are ways of life for many of us when we get here. You know, and on some of these, we just don't know any better, you know. Every bad thought you have about you was taught to you by somebody. You were not born with that thought. You were not born thinking you were defective, undesirable, anything wrong with you. You were not born thinking that. Somebody taught that to you. And it might have been you that taught that to you. Somebody else might have planted the seed, and you've been watering it for your whole life. And so, you know. So, but because of views such as this, you know, our expectations are rarely met. There was no trace of selfishness or spirituality in our approach to romance or marriage or children or stepchildren or friendships or anything, you know. And so if our relationships... Indeed, if our lives were going to work, we had to change. You know, there AA is full of wisdom that makes other people just look at us, you know, slack-jawed and think, what did he say? You know, but one of the things we say in AA is, if nothing changes, nothing changes. So, you know, if you have things going on like this. If you want your life to work, you have to change. You didn't come to AA or Al-Anon at the top of your game. You didn't come here to share your good fortune with everybody. You know, nor did I. So, you know. So Polly and I said about our redemption in several ways. We tried psychotherapy. You know, we wanted to be on the fast track to realized ultimate sobriety. So we tried psychotherapy, and psychotherapy was, there were patchy pockets of distrust of psychotherapy, and, you know, in Alcoholics Anonymous. We're particularly wary of psychiatrists because they can prescribe drugs. Psychologists just has to listen to you sit there and spew out all the drivel that we're capable of. But psychiatrists can prescribe drugs. We find patches of wariness about those guys in here. But, you know, on page 33 of our book, it says, now about health, a body badly burned by alcohol does not often recover overnight, nor do twisted thinking and depression vanish in a twinkling. Hear, hear. We are convinced that a spiritual mode of living is a most powerful health restorative. We who have recovered from serious drinking are miracles of mental health. That is true. Man, a half a bubble off plum did not even begin to explain us. But we have seen remarkable transformations in our bodies. Hardly one of our crowd now shows any dissipation. We talk about being forgiven by God. What is equally amazing to me is how I've been forgiven by my liver. Wow. But this does not mean that we disregard human health measures. God has abundantly supplied this world with fine doctors, psychologists, and practitioners of various kinds. Do not hesitate to take your health problems to such persons. Most of them give freely of themselves, that their fellows may enjoy sound minds and bodies. Try to remember that though God has wrought miracles among us, we should never belittle a good doctor or psychiatrist. Their services are often indispensable in treating a newcomer and in following his case afterward. Now, you can, if you don't like that opinion, opinions are available for every position on the planet. Okay, it is not hard at all to go find somebody that tells you if you take that, whatever that is, put it into your mouth and swallow it, you no longer qualify for sobriety or for membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay, that is not my affair. I have no medical degree, and I don't comment on things like that. But that's what the book says. Okay? That's what the book says. So we got here, and our serenity prayer upon arrival was me, 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 more, 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 now, 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 now. Amen. And, it's true. So our experience with therapy had mixed results. What we came to find out is that especially when you're new, we have an overwhelming desire to be liked. Okay, and a fundament of therapy is that I sit down and tell a therapist how I react to the world around me. How do I react to external stimuli? What does my mind do when I take it somewhere it normally doesn't go? That requires that I tell whoever my therapist is, give them information about me. Well, I pay no particular allegiance to the truth. The hell do I care about the truth? I want her to like me, for crying out loud. I'm going to tell her what I think she wants to hear to like me. And I don't need to ask her what she wants to hear. You know how we are when we're brand new. We can figure out what people want to hear. We don't need their help. We don't need to ask them anything. So what we found out for us was that psychotherapy informs, but it does not heal. AA heals. Alcoholics Anonymous heals. Therapy can be helpful. Alcoholics Anonymous is indispensable for me. So we got a more complete understanding of the nature of men and women and how they differ sexually, intellectually, and behaviorally, and you know, in our idiosyncrasies. Dishonesty and laziness and manipulative scheming didn't feel so threatening when they were pointed out to us by an impartial professional that was trying to be helpful. So we were able to drop or to relax at least many of our tight, unrealistic expectations of each other. And we have also had a lot of help dropping our expectations that we act in a way that's really not attuned to our sexual or psychological or gender-based nature. So this has allowed us to abandon a lot of our old ideas. Okay, I mean, I don't know who your role model was for relationships, but I know in my case, when I asked my mother for the first time, this is true, this is dead solid true, so help me, Hannah. When I asked my mother where babies came from, she started off by saying, well, God prepares a basket of love, a little basket of love in a mother's heart, and I don't know what she said beyond that. Turn that off. So, you know what I knew about that? Nothing, you know. I mean, I didn't know anything about any of that stuff. And I know a lot of guys that didn't. See, this is part of the waffle spaghetti thing. You know, women know a lot more about that stuff than men do. because it is comfortable for them to talk to each other about things like that. I went backpacking with a buddy of mine one time. He was embroiled in a very unpleasant divorce. When I got back, Polly said, "What did John say about the divorce?" And I said, "Nothing." She said, "Nothing?" I said, "No, we didn't even talk about it." "You didn't talk about it?" "No, why would we talk about that?" So fortunately, we became steadfast and very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon, and as promised, we've had a spiritual awakening. So we're confident that we will therefore never be the same. We will never, ever be the same. Because AA is a design for living that just removes most of the scratchiness from our personalities and lets us just enjoy our lives. And we freely and happily admit that everything we know about how to successfully conduct a relationship was learned in AA. It was taught to us by people just like you and by the 12 steps, the 12 traditions, the big book, and all the rest of the stuff that we do around here. But for a slightly different perspective, it is not for your benefit that I really take the principles and the suggestions of AA seriously. It's for my own benefit. I like me a lot better. I find me very tolerable. I am very, very comfortable with me when I do what this program recommends that I do. Be loving, be kind, be courteous, be compassionate, be helpful. I like me a lot better when I do that. It is to my great benefit and to my joy to act that way toward you. Yeah. Even if you don't need it, it is to my benefit to do those things. And that has been hard for me. I mean, well, it's not that it's been so hard, really. It's just that it's taken such a long time for me to really... First of all, I didn't believe in any of that crap when I got here, because that's what I thought it was. You know, I got to take care of me. I come first, I have to take care of me. Nobody else is going to do it, and nobody ever had. Nobody ever had. And if I let you get too close, I'm going to get stung somehow or other. And I got to take care of me. And I'm sorry about your problems, but I'm just so busy with me, I can't work you in. So it took me a long, long time to reach the point I am now. I mean, a long time. I have finally become convinced that what goes around comes around. And besides all of that, after all the love and kindness and compassion and especially forgiveness that has been shown to me by God Himself, on what grounds would I possibly withhold my forgiveness from anybody for anything? How could I ever do that? So, all of that has become, you know, if you just stay here, this is like water. AA is like water dripping on your tongue, you know, it'll grind you down. It's not like somebody shoving a fire hose in your mouth and say, "Turn her on." So, in the final analysis, it's not between me and Polly. It's between me and God. Always has been. You know, just took me longer to figure that out. You guys want a quick break? You good? Okay, I'm going to go on. If you get through before I do, please feel free. Okay, let's talk a little bit about, brush over lightly some of the characteristics of AA. And these are our traditions in action. This is some at the AA level. What do those traditions do for us? Okay. Well, first of all, Alcoholics Anonymous is an inclusive organization. We're not exclusive at all. You know, we don't test anybody. If you say you're an alcoholic, we just take your word for it. You know, usually most people don't cop to things like that unless there's something going on. But we're an inclusive organization. We look for ways to get you in, not keep you out. Okay? And all alcoholics are welcome as members. And everybody else that wants to come is available to come to open meetings whenever they want to. And we had a town we were in one time, and almost every meeting in town was closed. And they thought that was great. And I said, I think that's deplorable. I mean, what do you do when the cooperation with a professional community wants to bring doctors or therapists or ministers or something to your meetings? Where can they take them? Your meetings are closed, for crying out loud. What kind of sense does that make? So, and we have a responsibility statement on top of that that says, I am responsible. Whenever anyone, anywhere, reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA always to be there. And for that, I'm responsible. Okay, it doesn't say when any alcoholic anywhere. It says anyone. Okay, so do I welcome people at open meetings who have a problem with drugs, gambling, eating, shopping? Do I welcome those at open meetings? Absolutely. I'm delighted when they come. Do I think that AA can help them with their particular problem? Probably not. I don't suggest that we can. But when they come here, what do we give them? We give them understanding and information. We tell them how recovery, in general terms, works and what recovery outfits, how to find them, where they are, how they might locate them. So who knows better than we how to do all that stuff? So do I welcome them? Absolutely. Where else are they going to go? What does my responsibility statement say? You know, there was a terrible, terrible problem in Alcoholics Anonymous back in the 30s. They were having these meetings in Brooklyn, and some heroin addict took up residence on the doorstep of their meeting place, and they had a terrible time deciding what to do about that guy. He is out there dying, and they were genuinely afraid. This was not some bozo traditions lawyer or something that was upset. You know, they were really scared that their hold on sobriety was so tenuous that if they let a guy that's a drug addict come in, that's a heroin addict come in, it might destroy everything they had. It might cause them to be so, what's the word I'm looking for? Anyway. But they would lose what they had, and they'd all get drunk. But they felt great compassion for this guy, you know. They said, what are we going to do? So there was only two AA meetings in the world at that time, the one in Brooklyn and the one in Akron. So they let the guy in. They took a group conscience, and out of compassion, they let him in. So, you know, I welcome those people at open meetings. You know, they can't come to closed meetings, and I don't harbor any, you know, any blue in the sky blue ideas that we can solve everybody's problems. We can't. You know, the thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is that we identify with each other. We understand each other. When you tell me how you reacted to the disease of alcoholism, I understand and makes me useful to you. So I have a self-imposed responsibility to you. Our book says if you want what we have, then I have to be willing to help you get it, and I am. If you want what I've got, it is my responsibility to help you get that. We understand better than anybody We're not dealing with people who are bad and trying to get good. We're dealing with people who are sick and trying to get well. And tradition three states the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. That seems pretty loosey-goosey. That means just anybody can walk in, say, hey, I'm a member. And you know what we have to say? Welcome. We don't get to have an opinion. We don't get to do any tests. We don't do any blood tests or, you know, we don't do liver biopsies. We don't do any of that stuff. If you say you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, you are. And you remain a member until you say, I'm no longer a member. And we had to make it that indiscriminate because in 1941, the executive committee of the Los Angeles group of Alcoholics Anonymous wrote this letter. Dear Mrs. Irma L., at a meeting of the executive committee of the Los Angeles group of Alcoholics Anonymous held December the 4th, 1941, it was decided that your attendance at group meetings was no longer desired until certain explanations and plans for the future were made to the satisfaction of this committee. This action has been taken for reasons which should be most apparent to yourself. It was decided that should you so desire, you may appear before members of this committee and state your attitude. This opportunity may be afforded you between December 15th, 1941, between now and December the 15th of 1941. You may wish to communicate with us at the above address by that date. In case you do not wish to appear, we shall consider the matter closed and your membership is terminated. That's what we do. That's the kind of people we are when we first get here. We're the big cheese. We're important. We decide your fate for you. You know, and there are other examples that I won't read, but there are other examples. I mean, we're coming apart at the seams in the mid-40s. And people just, they really did not want any traditions. They were enjoying, you know, being called Your Majesty and my liege and, you know, and sire. So that's where we go without our traditions. That's the kind of stuff we do. And it's not okay with us that you're here. We want you here. My God, we go everywhere looking for you. We go to jails and prisons and asylums and, you know, everywhere. I mean, we go everywhere looking for you. We don't demand anything from you. You know, our steps of recovery are suggested. They're never demanded. We got a lot of people walking around with, you know, with furrowed brows who don't like that word being in the big book. They don't like for it to say, here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. But it's there. You know, but before that, the book says, if you want what we have, here's what we did. You know, here's what we suggest you do. If you want what we have. And so we don't demand that. You know, just think about that. We don't demand anything. What does God demand of you? Did God say, in effect, here's your life? Go live it the way you want to. If you want to be happy, joyous, free, here's some recommendations for you. Here's what I suggest. So, you know. And we're going to come along and demand that you do this or that? Nah, it doesn't make any sense. So, you know, so we've been given free will. And God did not meddle in our lives before he was invited in. He just didn't. At least in mine. And our book says if you want what we have and you're willing to go at any lengths to get it. So it seems to me that one of my jobs has got to be to show you what we have. That's what I have to do. I have to show you what we have. I mean, how can you answer that question if you're brand new and you walk in? So he says, you want what we have? So I don't know. You know, in the immortal words of June G, I don't know. I don't know what you have. All I know is I don't want what I have. So
5 minutes, we'll take a break.
5 minutes.
In 5 minutes? Yes, sir. So it seems to me that one of my jobs is to show you what we have. And so you can decide whether or not you want it. Then if you decide you want what we have, it is my job through friendship and sponsorship to help you get it. Not only do we demand nothing, you are totally free to ignore every suggestion we make without forfeiting your membership. And so, you know, just remember our 12 steps states that having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, not as a result, as the result of these steps. So that's why we do them. That's what we need when we get here. We need a spiritual awakening. And the kind of people we are when we arrive on AA's doorstep, we're not likely to have one unless we change drastically. And we need a psychic upheaval. We don't need to just change the way we talk. We need to change the way we think and live and have our being. So we're going to take a break.